Greetings and salutations, everyone. Welcome to another episode of my podcast. I am Harold C. Connolly, Jr., an explorer of space, time, and the human experience, and I do so in very specific ways. One way I do so is founding chair and professor of the Department of Geology at Rowan University in southern New Jersey, and also as mission sample scientist of OSIRIS-REx, which is NASA's New Frontiers 3 asteroid sample return mission. And I will add, I am the very first mission sample scientist in space exploration, which is a big burden to bear, I suppose. Today, I am coming to you once again from the Drake Building of the University of Arizona, which is the science heart of the OSIRIS-REx mission, where scientists and engineers and programmers and many people gather to work on the OSIRIS-REx mission, people coming and going, ebbing and flowing from all over the world. And today, I'm very pleased to have as my guest, Carl.
Thanks for having me.
Yes. Carl Hergenrother is the lead scientist for the Astronomy Working Group and a member of the OSIRIS-REx planning team. And Carl is an observer of the cosmos, but many other things. Carl, again, thank you for joining me. Tell us what you do on the OSIRIS-REx mission.
Well, I've been on this mission not quite from day one, which I believe was early 2004.
Yeah,
probably day 31.
Discovery, right.
Really early on. And so, having been on the mission for, 15 years now? 15 years next month? Done almost a little bit of everything. My first job was actually to help select what our target asteroid would be. And of course, this being 2004, we had a different target than the one that we're ultimately orbiting right now.
I didn't know that. So yes. See, this is great. Cool.
Yeah, and being a ground-based astronomer, I go to telescopes. I love observing. I love the night sky. I'm just as likely to have just as much fun at a large telescope, looking at some 22nd magnitude comet, as I am in my backyard with a pair of binoculars looking at a much brighter comet.
Right.
And so, yeah, I guess my claim to fame on the mission was that back in 2005, when I was looking for somewhere else for our mission to go to, because, pickings were slim back then. There weren't quite as many asteroids known.
There wasn't a lot of
observations. Yeah. And of the ones that were known, we didn't know a lot about them. And so one of the things I did was I was observing this asteroid known as 1999 RQ36. Was flying past the Earth. Was pretty bright. So it was, easy to get with a 60-inch telescope.
Pretty bright, okay.
Pretty bright. Not much was published on it. Mm-hmm. Turned out a lot was known about it. Just wasn't published on it. And so I went up there. I did light curves. I did colors.
Okay.
And it turned out to be a B-type. And that, of course, flagged my interest because,
Carbonaceous-like.
And also, if you look at some B-types, Phaethon's a B-type.
No. Oh, right.
Els Pizarro, Wilson-Harrington, all these hybrid comet asteroid objects, which I've always had an interest in, were B-types.
Okay.
And so I kind of flagged this and said, huh. Then instead of doing, the usual literature search, I did a Google search. Whole bunch of stuff known about this object.
Oh, really?
Spectral stuff, radar imaging, all this stuff. It just hadn't been published.
Okay.
But it was on people's websites and stuff like that. And so, I quickly emailed Mike and Dante, Mike Drake. And I think within like 2 days, it became the target.
Wow. So cool.
So then after that, I led the campaign.
We owe you a lot. Thank you.
Yep. So, I led the campaign to characterize the object. And that's the astronomy working group really grew out of, what could we learn about this?
Right. This the time I got on in 2008, you had been working hard on that, actually.
Yeah. And as a result, for an asteroid that, up till a few months ago, had not been visited by a spacecraft. It was the best characterized asteroid out there.
You're right, absolutely. Dante's made that point many times as well. Yes.
Yeah.
So absolutely. And fortunately for us, and which you led a lot of the effort for the pre-encounter characterization, we got so much right.
We got a lot right.
That was so cool.
Yeah.
It's like kick-ass cool.
Yeah.
Yeah.
We got a lot right. Maybe right for the wrong reasons, but it was right.
Well, Fair enough. But I think we got a lot of it right for the right reasons.
We got a lot of it right.
Yeah. So I want to jump ahead and jump back again because I don't want to forget the next question I have for you, but or discussion topic. You do a lot of work with the community.
Yes.
Outreach. Working with the Amateur Astronomy Club. Tell us about that. That must be incredibly fun.
Yeah, because, I mean, I'm still an amateur. I mean, I'm an astronomer. For me, there was no difference between professional and amateur. Right. A lot of times you'll see people, they'll start in high school or grade school in their backyard.
Right.
Then once they get that PhD, they no longer sit there and really enjoy the night sky.
It's true.
I do both. Yeah. I do both. So I am involved with quite a few kind of amateur professional astronomy groups, like the International Meteor Organization. I'm a editor for their journal.
Oh, I didn't know that.
I am on the board of directors for the American Meteor Society.
Wow.
I'm on the board, and as a secretary, I'm on the board as well as the coordinator or kind of lead for the comet section for the Association of Lunar and Planetary Observers, the ALPO.
Look at that. You work with somebody for over 10 years and there's things you don't know about. Oh, that's so cool.
And it's great because, it's nice to have feet in both camps.
Yeah.
And there really should be more of a synergy between the two. And there is, but there needs to be, should be more.
Well, yeah, but I think, don't you think that at some level it's individualized, that pivotal point that synergizes the quote amateur end quote group to the professionals? I mean, I got my start in geology really through my ninth grade earth science teacher, Louis B. Dutovsky, and the Delaware Valley Earth Science Society in southern New Jersey, which I still go to and I give talks to, and we see them at our dig days at the fossil park. And these are my roots, I mean, and it's so fun, and I love it. And in fact, Lou sent me a Christmas card this year where he wrote me a beautiful note where he said, "Now it's time for you to teach me. I want to learn about Bennu."
Yeah.
So that was 1979. Mm-hmm. He was my teacher.
Mm-hmm.
A long time ago. So, all right. So I digress, but yeah.
Well, speaking of which, I mean, you're a Southern Jersey boy. I'm a Northern Jersey boy.
Right.
Bergen County. About that. I mean, born in the Bronx, but mostly I grew up in Northern New Jersey.
Born in the Bronx.
Yeah. Spent the year living there.
I remember.
Still got relatives there.
I remember teaching in CUNY in one spring break, after spring break, because, the students never went anywhere. And they said, one of the students said, "Did you go somewhere for spring break, professor?" I said, "Did, I went somewhere I've never been before." They said, "Where was that?" I said, "The Bronx."
Yep. So still got a lot of contacts. That's why I got the Yankee bag.
So let's turn it back to Osiris Rex. So the enthusiasm for science in general permeates your life, both at work and away from work. You still do your own science at times. And the wonderful thing is that you don't have a PhD.
I do not.
And you have continued to push forward, blossom, produce, write papers, etc. So it's a testament to the fact that you don't have to follow a standard classic model.
No, you don't. And it's kind of the path less taken. I mean, there's plenty of people in science who don't have PhDs. But
I don't think most people know that, though.
Right. But usually it's hard to not have a PhD, and definitely not even have a master's, and still be doing science.
Yeah, okay.
Publishing.
Right.
Leading those sort of things.
Right.
And that's, I mean, off the mitt, I'm not sure it's the path I would recommend for people.
Mm-hmm.
If you want to be, a research scientist,
mm-hmm.
a lot of doors are closed to you if you don't have a PhD. I mean, most jobs are faculty type positions,
correct.
And all those doors are closed to you
right.
if you don't have a PhD. Well, some smaller schools, you can get away with a
pretty
master's.
Pretty much they're closed, I would say, at the 99% level. There is the occasional person who is appointed to a faculty position, Peter, for example.
Right.
Peter Smith here at University of Arizona before.
Yes.
He didn't have a PhD, and the former director of Palomar Observatory, right? Caltech, he was a Caltech professor. He didn't have a PhD. I can't remember his name. I can see his face for years. Anyway, whatever, yeah. So, well, that's right. So you're contributing to science, contributing to exploration of space, and being a key player in the OSIRIS-REx team, or one of the key players, yeah. So what's been, for you, what has been one of the most challenging aspects of being on Osiris Rex?
For me, documentation.
Okay.
I am not, well,
good at documenting what you observe.
I'm good at documenting what I observe.
Right.
I am a planner. I definitely plan.
Yeah, you're on the
planning. But maybe it's because of the observing side, where you can spend all week planning your observing run, and it all goes to naught.
Because it's
cloudy.
Yeah, right.
So instead of coming up with, and I've seen observers do this, where every second of the night is, you know, accounted for, and then one thing goes wrong. Or it doesn't even have to go wrong. One thing changes. This object's more interesting than I thought. I should spend more time on it. I can't now. I have a plan. I said I was going to observe X number of objects, and I'm going to fit them in. So what I usually do, my way of planning, is I just say, here is a group of objects that I can observe. And I just let the night kind of develop as is. So it's very different when you have a mission like here, where you're writing documentation to the most minute detail on what you think you're going to do 5 years from now.
Right. We've discussed that several times I have with several other guests, and I don't think most people realize when you're running a space mission, you have to plan years in advance.
Yes.
To the tiniest minutia of how much memory you're going to be used, mm-hmm. how much power, everything, right?
Yep.
Go ahead.
And no matter how well you plan, you really can never anticipate all the things that will change. Not necessarily go wrong, because it's not always that things go wrong. Things just change.
Right. You have
becomes,
to,
you know.
Right. You have to be flexible.
Instead of observing using these kind of observations, well, we're going to do these because we found out that this is what's showing the interesting parts of the asteroid.
That's a good point. I think one of the observations I've made, whether it's right or wrong, but it seems to be just an observation at this point, is we work with a lot of engineers mm-hmm. who are driven by requirements. And when something doesn't quite fit or is not compatible with the requirements, it causes a little bit of a shuffle, shall we say?
Yes.
A little frustration.
Mm-hmm.
And as scientists, we just say, oh, okay, well, I got to change it.
Yeah. Oh, especially
can't
when...
Can't do what I was going to do, sorry.
Especially when you get asked questions like, you know, okay, we want to know everything about the asteroid. But let's be honest, for most asteroids, it's a dot in the sky.
Right.
And we think we know,
but
do we really know?
Yeah.
You're kind of going out on a limb saying that.
Right. Well, which is why we're exploring.
One
of the reasons why we're exploring is because we do not know.
Right. But in order to properly scope your mission, you kind of have to know already quite a bit about your object.
Right.
You can't go in completely blind.
No, and you have to make certain assumptions. I talked about this yesterday. I can remember the engineers asking about the composition of the material because they needed to do some calculations and shake tests on their sample return capsule. And, you know, I could only give them the best educated guess at what it might be based on the analogs we have in the meteorites. And then when they pushed me for more, I was like, I can't give you any more. That's why we're going to the asteroid. I don't.
Right.
You know, for me, I've reached my limit of what I can say with confidence, you know.
Yeah. Remember getting the question, you know, what's the albedo? When they were specking the GNC LIDAR. You know, what's the albedo for a carbonaceous object? It's like, well, on average, between like 2 and 12%.
Right.
But that's a global average. There could be, as we found out with Ceres, you could have 70, 80, 90% albedo spots.
Right.
So in reality, it's open-ended. You should expect anything. But of course, you can't plan for anything because you can't design for anything.
Yeah. You have to have some specs that you need to do for. And then you have to be able to be flexible, which is exactly the situation I think every space mission has found itself in at some level.
Mm-hmm.
When Hayabusa 2 arrived at asteroid Lugu, as you well know, it was a huge surprise. A good surprise in that they actually got the general shape model or shape correct from light curves, which means basically looking at how the light moves around an object. We know that can be completely wrong, because we had that on Rosetta's target comet, right? But the surface of Lugu is considerably different than what we expected.
Yes.
Yeah. So, and the bottom line, as I said yesterday as well in an interview, the asteroid is not complying with the engineering requirements.
Right.
Actually, Hayabusa 2 will do its first collection event. Will perform its first collection event end of this week on Friday. Mm-hmm. So 3 p.m. Thursday afternoon here.
So 22nd here, probably 23rd there.
Yes, Friday there. Mm-hmm. Right. No, 22nd, Friday.
Right.
So Thursday here, 21st.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, so it's like, so I think it's, for us, it may be 2 here and, yeah, it may be 2 p.m. Mountain time on Thursday mm-hmm. afternoon. And it's like a 2-hour window or something like that.
We'll be getting semi-live images? Will we know?
I don't know. There is a live feed that's going to happen. I know I have that. As a science team member, also Keiko forwarded it to us. I was originally going to go there, but decided it was not a good idea because it's a really busy time. I think Dante and I will some other people fly there later on after the event occurs, because I was supposed to be in Sapporo right now, but I wound up canceling that trip for professional and personal reasons, which worked out. It was a good thing in the end. Tell me this is kind of a stupid cliche question, but I want to hear it from you anyway. What is the most exciting moment for you so far on OSIRIS-REx? I mean, I can pinpoint 2 of the most exciting moments for me, but for you, what is something that was like a pivotal moment that sticks in your mind, a fixed point in time for you? Is there any?
Well, it's kind of funny because, you know, as part of the astronomy team, once we got to the asteroid, you know, my responsibility was to take, you know, the astronomy observations.
Right.
By astronomy observations, when the asteroid was still a point source and measuring its colors, rotations, whatever. As we found out, that turned out to be a little harder than we thought.
Mm-hmm.
But we did get good data out of that. But one of the other things is I was looking for hazards. Dust, satellites, things that might be buzzing around the asteroid.
Right.
And never really expected to find anything. But you got to look anyway. And there was a point, I think, towards the end of that satellite search, which was, I think, early November, where a little bit of depression was kind of creeping in because it was dawning on me that I wasn't finding anything.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Which is great. I mean, I guess less work. But, you know, it was... I almost felt like my science was kind of done.
Okay.
You know, my time to shine was done, and in a few months I'll be on science planning, which is interesting and cool and a great team to work with.
Right, right.
But you don't make discoveries on science planning. You enable other people to make discoveries on science
planning. Right, 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 right.
And then all of a sudden, you know, just browsing through images that maybe, well, images that weren't taken for any science reason, they were taken for optical navigation reasons.
It's always the way it is.
In early January. Just blinking through the images, exhausted, working on 20 minutes of sleep because I had spent up all night doing a rough draft of, you know, one of the papers.
Mm-hmm.
And then all of a sudden I see stuff, particles,
right,
around the asteroid.
Right, right.
This exact thing that I was kind of looking for in September, October, November,
mm-hmm.
but we were much further from the asteroid at the time.
Mm-hmm.
And so, I mean, talk about, you know, you plan for years and years and years to look for these things, never expecting to find them.
Right, because you just have
to. Every time I'd bring up an image, I would kind of fantasize what it would look like to see one. You know, will I see a satellite? Will I see a cometary jet? Will I see a ring? Wouldn't that be cool to see a ring? Not expecting it, but, you know, you never know. You know? And then all of a sudden, at a time when I'd already kind of given up on expecting to see something, I see something.
Yeah.
And the funny thing is, it looked kind of like, in my head, I was imagining
what it would be. Yeah.
What this to look like.
That's so cool. That's great. Yeah.
So,
okay, cool. So, that's what exploring is all about, is surprises. Unfortunately, our surprises have been delightful.
Oh, yes.
Although the surface is a little bit rougher than we expected, so it's going to take a little bit more energy to find a place to sample, but we will. I'm confident we will.
Mm-hmm.
The whole time you're doing all this, you're also a family person.
Yep.
Yeah, you have a family, you have a partner, you have twins, right?
Twin boys, 8-year-old boys.
Wow.
Yep.
Wow, not the twins, but wow that they're 8 now, because I remember when they were born. Gosh, I feel old.
We were right in the proposal. Yeah. That was proposal season.
Right, right.
All that was going down.
8 years, that's how fast that moves.
I know. And it's funny, because they're born on... basically within a day or two of a lot of major events in OSIRIS-REx. It's September 24th.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's kind of EGA was on the 23rd. Sample comes back on the 23rd.
That's right. Very auspicious.
Yes.
Tibetans would say, yeah. It's funny, the whole growing old thing. I remember when my friends Stan Love and Jancy McPhee had their first son, Gavin. We were all in Pasadena. And of course, Stan went on to be an astronaut on flying STS-122. but anyway, long story short, I hadn't seen him for a while, a couple of years ago, and I went called him up when I was at JSC, and we had dinner together. And in the middle of dinner, I said something about, well, how's Gavin? And Stan says, well, you know, he's, you know, in freshman in college now. When did that happen? What do you mean? He's a freshman in college. Yeah, wow. Time moves. Isn't it key? But that's what we're doing, isn't it, on OSIRIS-REx, is looking backwards in time at the same time we're living real time.
Yeah. So
we're going back 4.567 billion years for the material that we're going to be collecting, and several millions of years of evolution of Bennu in the shape it is now, up to maybe a billion years or something like that. Yeah.
Oh, definitely.
Yeah.
I mean, it really is a time capsule.
Yep, absolutely.
And at the same time, it's also a picture of our future. There will be a time when humanity will start traveling, I don't know if traveling among the stars, but definitely traveling among the planets.
Right.
And those asteroids are going to be the gas stations.
That's a good point. Actually, they very well may be. That's right. Yeah. Not science fiction, science fact. But I think, speak to that for a minute. What do you think it would entail for civilization as a whole? Meaning all of Earth in general, to actually start exploring space more rigorously with humans?
I mean, it's probably going to be similar to when, you know, Europeans were colonizing the New World. I mean, you had two reasons why people came over here, economic and social.
Right.
And the social was a really important part, for especially like the English colonies. A lot of people came over here to get away from what, you know, various repressions. Well, mainly religious.
That's the party line anyway, or else they were sent away.
I mean, the thing with space is, it's really difficult to live in space. So you have to have a strong driving force to get you out there.
Right.
And that could be economic. Right now, I don't see that, but that can change in 50 to 100 years.
Mm.
And it could very well be social, which is something you can't really predict.
Right.
How history is going to play out, what social forces are going to start pushing people in different directions. It could be as simple as the Earth is crowded and people just want to, that's the new frontier. We just want to get away and be left alone.
It could be that simple. You're absolutely right. Yeah, it could be that simple. And nations that can afford to do it would.
So,
it's interesting philosophical / cultural and intellectual discussion.
Though, I mean, the way things are going, I think it might actually turn out to be less nations and more corporations.
Yeah, that's another way to look at it, right? A lot of science fiction has done that, and I'm fine with that.
I'm fine with that, too.
That's
not necessarily a bad thing.
No, I don't think so.
Because it's always going to have to be the people with money, whether it's nations or corporations, that get the ball rolling.
Right.
And then eventually the prices come down enough, or there's enough infrastructure and space that people can go out on their own and maybe just live on the fringes.
Right. In fact, it may be easier for corporations to start doing that than for nations. The old model of space exploration, you know, it almost fell apart as soon as it started working.
Yes.
You go back and look at it historically anyway. Yeah.
And it is interesting because you look at it and we always say it's space exploration, but how much of like human exploration really is space exploration?
Right.
Mostly you're going a couple hundred miles up.
Yeah, correct. Right.
I mean, going to the moon, that was true exploration. Of course, what we do in the robotic side really is exploration. I mean, we couch it as science, but it really is.
It's exploration. You're right, because the science is definitely there, and we've really understood a lot more about planetary bodies from the robotic missions. But you're right, it's exploring. The great Voyager missions, you know, the flybys of four days.
Yes.
All those images.
And that's what I grew up on.
Me too.
Watching on PBS.
Me too. Downloading live on PBS. I told this story recently on another podcast that I have a VHS tape, which I show my students in my introductory gateway course. And they say, what's that? And then I tell them, and they say, oh, I've heard of a VHS. And I said, look on the label. It says Voyager. I taped that live. I sat in front of that television. You know?
Yeah.
And I thank my mother for that too, because at 4 years of age, the man walked on the moon.
Mm-hmm.
Right. The moon landing occurred. My mother put me down in front of the black and white Zenith television we had in the living room and said, "Watch this. You'll remember." That's what she said to me. I still remember it. I was 4 years old. And I sat there as a four-year-old child in awe. And I've always wanted to explore space, and here we are. Yeah.
I mean, I'm a few years younger, but my dad was big into the space program. And so my basement was full of books on space flight, aircraft, whatever. You know, he was a mechanic, airplane mechanic. And so I'd just go downstairs, and I, you know, from early age, I was reading and stuff. And by kindergarten, I knew I wanted to be an astronomer, among other things.
Right.
You know, weatherman, astronomer, baseball player, sure, which is funny, because my degree is actually in atmospheric sciences.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah, it's not even in astronomy.
I didn't know that. Oh, that's I so was, cool.
When I was taking my physics courses, I don't know, something happened when I got to college. That's when the anxiety really hit. And so I just wasn't even comprehending most physics.
Hmm.
And so I got to a point where it's like, you know what? I need to learn these tools if I want to be in astronomy. But I'm not interested in what they're teaching as astronomy, which was four astronomy courses and all math and physics. So there was very little that was, it was all applicable to astronomy, but it wasn't directly astronomy.
Hmm.
So I was losing interest. And I sat there and like, well, what can I learn that'll teach me these tools? And hold my interest at least for another 3-4 semesters to get me out without failing out of college, undergrad. I'm like, well, weather. Always interested in the weather. Still am very Fantastic. Much interested in the weather.
Fantastic. I had no
idea. You still have to learn your vector calc and Diffie Q and all that stuff. I mean, you're not doing triple integrals, but you're
right.
You're
but
getting,
it's a real practical application of it.
Yeah.
The sense that you can almost be tangible with. Yeah.
And I mean, as an astronomer, especially as a ground-based observer, you better know the weather.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. Right? Yeah. That's true.
It's kind of like being a pilot. You got to know the weather.
Oh, that's right. So, is there? It's interesting you talk about anxiety as an undergraduate. Mm-hmm. I think in part, I used to love physics too, but I was a geology major, and that's because I like to visualize. Because in geology, we visualize a lot, and it's easy.
Yes.
And then was perhaps my one sort of moment of realization when I was a junior, I was still frustrated with certain things as an undergraduate. Long story short, I went to the help center on campus, on Livingston campus, because I went to Rutgers. Mm-hmm. And a kind person helped me out and discovered that I'm actually dyslexic, which was just beginning to be something recognized in the early 80s, or mid-80s rather, right?
So
and eventually I learned how to deal with things differently, so...
Yeah, I was kind of in the same boat. I mean, I'm also very, you know, I'm visual, kind of a linear thinker.
Right.
I don't think mathematically. I can do math, but I don't think mathematically.
Just like me, I don't think mathematically either, but we can do it.
Yes.
We know how to do it. That's the key point. Like, it's like French. Over the years, I lost my ability to communicate complex issues in the French language, orally, certainly written.
Mm-hmm.
But when I hear it spoken, I still understand a large percentage of it.
Yeah.
So that's because math is just a language.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Right. Anything you want to add before we sign off here? Anything you want to say to people or any other?
Oh, we always we can put on the spot.
Yeah, I hate people do. I like to leave the last moment to my guests in case they want to say something that we didn't cover that you'd like to have covered. No, I guess we're good. Okay.
I'm sure as soon as you turn that off, 1,000 things will pop up. That's part of the anxiety thing. As soon as I get put on the spot, it's like,
sorry.
You shut down.
I'm sorry.
And then you sit there, three hours later, it's like, I did have a comeback.
Well, we can always do another podcast in 6 months to a year. And I want to thank you very much for taking time out of your busy day here at the Drake Building.
We got another meeting coming up.
I know.
We could do a whole podcast on how we spend all our time in meetings.
We spend a lot of time in meetings and telecoms. That's very true. Well, thank you very much, Carl. I really appreciate it.
Thank you.